Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to own a restaurant and buy an investment property and get a new car. No, a really nice one.
Let's get started on your five-year plan. CIBC, ambitions made real.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 29th of November, these are our main stories. No longer deep inside the Indian Himalayas. All 41 construction workers trapped for more than 2 weeks are safely rescued, as more prisoners and hostages are exchanged on the fifth day of a truce. A top UN official says there's only one solution to the conflict between Israel and Hamas.
Violence and military solutions are not going to achieve the much-needed political solution that actually leads to a peaceful future for both Israelis and Palestinians. There's no way out.
And Sierra Leone's government admits the unrest of recent days was an attempted military coup. Also in this podcast, Finland closes its border with Russia, claiming Moscow is attacking it with asylum seekers. And
when I started diving, I was always the only black person on the boat. Whether it's your wetsuit not fitting, whether it's someone asking, are you going to dive with all of that hair? My friends would also say, why do you do white people things?
We hear from South Africa's first female black dive instructor and one of the BBC's top 100 women. There is joy in India, where 41 construction workers have emerged from a collapsed tunnel in the Himalayas after being trapped for 17 days. There were scenes of jubilation and celebration as the freed men, low-wage workers from some of the poorest parts of the country, were finally pulled alive through a pipe. Chaudhary's son was one of those rescued.
Sir,
I am very happy. I am 55 and I have seen life. But my son is very young and he has a long life. I want him to fight every storm in his long life.
The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has congratulated all the rescuers involved in the operation, which has been beset with problems and multiple setbacks. Our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain, was at the scene when the men were freed.
It was an incredible day that was 17 days in the making. We have been covering this story for the last week and a half, and there was such a palpable difference in terms of the mood here when we arrived, as we heard of the news that they had breached through the last bit of debris and that they were going to be able to rescue those workers. The excitement was incredible. They were pulled out from inside the tunnel on stretchers on wheels, and then they were quickly checked out by doctors, and then they were whisked away in ambulances that were already parked inside the mouth of the tunnel, and everyone was taken to a nearby hospital where they're getting a full checkup by doctors.
So how did the rescue teams finally make the breakthrough? Because, you know, we've been covering this story, the machinery just kept on breaking down or failing. It was looking really scary.
It was. So a few days ago, when the drilling machine finally broke down and they decided that they were going to abandon it altogether because it was the focus of so many technical difficulties, they broke it up into pieces and they pulled it out of the tunnel. Once they did, they saw that they had about 8 to 10 meters of debris left to break through in order to reach those trapped men. So what they did is they were installing a pipe that was 800 millimeters wide that they were putting in through the debris to rescue the men. So what they did, instead of trying to drill a hole and then push it through, they just pushed the pipe through, and then they would manually remove the debris that would have fallen into the pipe until they finally breached the last of the rubble, and the rescuers were met with cheers and clapping from the men that were inside.
So what's going to happen to this tunnel now?
That is a very good question. I think that there are questions about what happens now and why were the safety precautions that were recommended not followed. There should have been a safety tunnel built in concurrently with the tunnel or the roadway that was being built. That was not done. And then there are questions about whether this area is stable enough to withstand that kind of tunneling in order to create this roadway. And we were speaking to one man that was working on the rescue operation, and he was saying that as they were tunneling through, there was another rescue attempt happening from the top of the mountain. They were drilling through, and he would say that that was putting them at so much risk because the mountain was still moving and the risk of a landslide was still so high.
Samira Hussain. 10 more Israeli hostages and 2 from Thailand are now back in Israel after being released by Hamas. Crowds of well-wishers waited in the southern city of Ofakim, holding flags, chanting and singing songs. In return, Israel has freed another 30 Palestinian prisoners. The latest release came on the fifth day of the truce between Israel and Hamas. As many as 170 people remain captive in Gaza, including children, more than 50 days after their abduction on October the 7th. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, gave me an update.
Well, we've seen a group of 10 Israelis who have been released. We've seen them in the now familiar scenes as they arrive at the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing with waiting ambulances. We saw most of them getting out of the Red Cross vehicles that they were transported in. They all seemed to be walking and, as far as one could make out, in reasonable physical shape. This was quite an elderly group. 4 women over the age of 70, including 84 four-year-old Ditsa Heyman, and also several members of a single family, the Limburg family, including the youngest of the group today, Mia Limburg, who's 17 years old, who seemed to be carrying her pet dog, a Shih Tzu called Bella, which is a fairly remarkable detail. 2 further Thai workers were also released.
And also a meeting of intelligence chiefs in Qatar.
Yes, it seems as though the heads of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, the CIA director, William Burns, and the head of Egyptian security were all in Doha. The focus of the negotiations is very much how to keep this release process going. Today is the first of 2 extra days that have already been agreed between the various parties. But there is obviously a hope that we will see another 48-hour extension beginning the day after tomorrow. And then there are discussions about whether it could be extended beyond that. So clearly the fact that we now have had 5 consecutive days in which the Israelis and Hamas and the other Palestinian groups holding hostages in Gaza have all been seen to uphold their side of the deal does raise hopes that this deal could continue and we could see further groups of hostages released in the coming days.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. The conflict between Israel and Gaza may have paused, but the fighting has already led to huge suffering on both sides. The UN Human Rights Commissioner, Volker Turk, visited the region recently and didn't mince his words, accusing both sides of committing war crimes. Our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks, spoke to him on his return and asked him first why he'd been so blunt.
I was at the border to Gaza in Rafah. I met Palestinian children who had injuries that I have rarely seen in my life. Spine injuries. Some of them couldn't even talk because they were in such deep trauma and shock. I also met families of Israeli hostages and I saw their pain. I can see there is immense suffering out there and that suffering is created from humans to humans. And I also see that some of the suffering is not seen by the other side. So it is really important that each and everyone understands that the suffering is happening on all sides and that we must do something about it. And international law is the answer to it. And when it comes to the blockade and now the siege, if you look at international law, it's very clear. You should never collectively punish people when you are in these type of situations. And that's what has happened. Of course, now humanitarian assistance comes in, but it's still inadequate and we need much more of it. And it should not have happened. There should not have been this denial of humanitarian assistance at the start.
Israel didn't even invite you into Israel when you went to the Middle East. I mean, the UN, it doesn't seem very popular, certainly with Israel at the moment.
Well, I still haven't given up. I was able to go to Egypt. I was able to go to the border. I was able to go to Jordan. I have asked to go to Israel. I will keep asking for it. And I hope they will see it in their interest that I come and that also I can deploy a team to Israel. And again, to Gaza and the West Bank, because we have only got national staff there at the moment.
What would you like to happen immediately? This truce is due to come to an end. There has been talk that the war will resume with all its ferocity when it finishes.
I hope very much that this pause brings back sense to people, that they realize that violence and military solutions are not going to achieve the much-needed political solution that actually leads to a peaceful future for both Israelis and Palestinians. There's no way out. And it requires negotiations, it requires those who have influence over both Hamas and Israel to exercise that influence and to bring them back to, frankly, a negotiating table that brings an end to this violence, that actually makes sure that there is an envisioned future for both. And of course, it will have to involve the Palestinian authorities and the state of Palestine. That's absolutely clear. We don't need more violence. We don't need more conflict. We actually need something that brings them all together and finds a solution to it. If you want the violence to end, the occupation must end. I think we can never give up, including not on what now appears to be the most intractable situation. I do think that everyone knows that we cannot go back to before. So there needs to be a different way of dealing with this situation. I also hope that what we have been for years saying about the human rights impact of the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory will finally be heard. And that's really the biggest message. Human rights have to be taken much more seriously. They cannot just be relegated to an anodyne discussion in the Human Rights Council to really lead to action by member states, not just by us. Because frankly, my own colleagues in Gaza Strip have been dying. I mean, the UNRWA colleagues were killed. I have my own staff who are victims.
Volker Turk speaking to Imogen Folks. The host of this year's UN climate talks, COP28, is the United Arab Emirates, where the summit starts on Thursday. Now, a BBC Arabic investigation has revealed that the UAE's own oil industry is not as clean as it claims to be. It's releasing air pollution that is likely to be damaging the health of its own population living in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And as Haber Bital reports, it's not just the UAE population that is suffering from this avoidable type of pollution.
If you're coughing, you use it. Those coughs. The bad ones.
The first time Jassim had an asthma attack, he was unable to breathe. He's 5 years old and lives in Kuwait. His father says he didn't go to preschool for an entire year because of his condition.
We don't realize that in Kuwait we have pollution and the problems that will keep affecting health, lungs and children in the future.
The country has some of the worst air quality in the world. It's often blamed on sandstorms that cover cities and turn the sky a thick, dusty orange. But recent studies tell a different story. Dr. Barak Al-Ahmad has been studying the impact of air pollution on people's health in the Gulf region, especially in Kuwait.
If you say that the air pollution in Kuwait is all from dust, then you can throw your hands in the air and say, there's nothing I can do about it. That is not the case. What we found out, that only 40% comes from the desert. 42% comes from sources that involve power plants and involve the oil industry. This is man-made air pollution that we can regulate, we can reduce, we can in fact eliminate.
This is the sound of gas flares, huge columns of fire illuminating the sky, night and day, burning excess gas from oil production and releasing toxic black smoke. It's a practice that is almost entirely avoidable and most countries have pledged to end it. But the BBC has found that it's widespread across the Gulf. In Iraq, the Rumaila oil field, managed by BP and PetroChina, is the biggest source of flaring in the world. BP and PetroChina told the BBC they are working with the operator of this field to reduce its flaring and emissions. In the United Arab Emirates, some of its worst flares are hidden away from the public on rigs out at sea. A BBC Arabic investigation has found that toxic air pollution from these oil and gas sites is carried by wind across hundreds of kilometers, potentially impacting the health of millions of people, including those living in Dubai, the home of this year's climate conference, COP28.
The world needs maximum energy, minimum emissions. This is
Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, this year's COP president. He is also the chief executive of the UAE's oil giant, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, or ADNOC.
I am very pleased to say that over 20 oil and gas companies have positively answered the call to step up and eliminate routine flaring by 2030.
But BBC analysis shows the UAE has not reduced its gas flaring in a decade. And despite ADNOC's policy of zero routine flaring, the company has actually increased levels in at least three offshore oil and gas fields. ADNOC says that across all their operations, they are focused on their goal of eliminating routine flaring by 2030.
Today is his first day in first grade, so I hope he will be able to adapt to other kids.
Back in Kuwait, Jassim's parents have decided to send him back to school.
Are you happy?
Yeah.
I am so happy. He will experience a new world. He will meet new kids. He will make friendships. We will see how he deals with his asthma. I can only hope for the best.
For the first time ever, this year's climate conference will have a day focusing on health. For people like Jassim, what will or won't be decided there could have a life-changing impact.
Hiba Bitar reporting. Zandile Nu-Lavu grew up in the South African township of Soweto, nowhere near the ocean. But at 35, Zandile is now South Africa's first black female dive instructor and founder of the Black Mermaid Foundation, an organisation seeking to get children from vulnerable communities to befriend the ocean and take care of its habitat. She's been named as one of the BBC's 100 Women of 2023. But Zandile's connection to the water hasn't always been positive, so let's hear more from her.
When I was growing up, every single time there was a drowning, whether by a river close to my grandmother's or later on out at sea, it would be said that a snake took the child. And so you grow up with this, stay away from all big bodies of water, and it causes a fear inside your body. And then externally, as you grow up, there's this narrative of how, you know, oh, but black people don't swim. This narrative lives around us, but very quickly it becomes internalized. And that just builds on the fear. The first time I saw the ocean, I was about 12 years old. And then in 2016, I go on the snorkel trip. As we went on to jump into the water, I started freaking out. I'm drowning, it is messy. In the moments that follow is a self-to-self, calm down. And as I looked beneath the surface of the water, there was this light beneath it, and those were the sun rays on the coral reef. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. Fell in love. When I started diving, I was always the only black person on the boat as a guest. Whether it's your wetsuit not fitting, whether it's someone asking, are you going to dive with all of that hair? And you're just like, what does it mean to remind me that I'm the outsider? My friends would also say, why do you do white people things? The ocean for me is such a hard place because it holds so much history around black bodies. There were all of these racial tensions because in South Africa, people were jailed for being at the wrong beaches, never mind being dispossessed of their ocean-facing homes. There's the physical history that creates a disassociation as to who belongs in the water.
Wait, are we there yet?
When I qualified as a freediving instructor in 2020, I knew one thing. I did not want to work in a dive shop continuing the norm. I wanted to use the certificate to be able to bring change in my community. So the Ocean Hub is a dream that I had sometime last year.
There it is! Oh, it's so good to see it!
What would happen if we had this hub where the kids could come to, where we read together, we learn together, but also maybe expand into drama, because kids don't often speak about what they're going through. The Ocean Hub for me is a place that is a safe space for the kids to dream. That's an important way to expand worlds that can feel very tiny and very suffocating. The idea that we need to protect and save our oceans cannot be done by a minimal part of the population. That's been a very difficult world in trying to communicate climate change problems, rising ocean levels. It's hard to have that discussion when it feels like this white ocean has always been advocated by white people. So for me, it says we need all hands on deck to ensure that these little ones that are growing up become ocean guardians in their own right. They are able to advocate for the protection of our ocean.
Zandile Nu-Lavu, South Africa's first black female dive instructor and one of the BBC's 100 women. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the cruise on the Med that turned out a bit like the Alien movie.
The ship's doctor, with a scalpel, split my toe open, then squeezed out what looked like milk, but with tea leaves in, and I'm going, like, what's those little dots? And he went, well, they're eggs.
After days of speculation, the government in Sierra Leone has now acknowledged that there was indeed an attempted coup on Sunday. 20 people, including 13 military officers, were killed when armed men attacked military barracks and prisons in the capital, Freetown. The government says the attacks were planned and coordinated. The information minister is Cherno Ba.
The state security and intelligence forces at Ondi Tami now say the November 26 incident na be a failed attempted coup. The intention of them people here na be for illegally subvert and overthrow the democratically elected government.
There were further clashes with those suspected of plotting to overthrow the government. One person was detained in a Freetown suburb on Tuesday. The government had at first been careful not to label the uprising as a coup attempt. So, why the change? Our West Africa correspondent is Maini Jones.
Many people suspected, particularly in Freetown, that this was an attempted coup, but the government said that what it wanted to do was speak to the 13 or so people they have under detention, currently interrogate them, find out what their motivations were, and only after they'd done that would they be able to say whether it was definitely an attempted coup. But this comes as people in the neighbourhood of Murrytown this morning in Freetown reported hearing some gunshots. The police said that it was part of an operation to apprehend one of the people responsible. So they're still very much looking for some of the people that were behind this attack on Sunday, as well as the 2,000 or so prison inmates that were released during the attack. There's a nighttime curfew that is now in place indefinitely. The authorities have said from 9 p.m. till 6 a.m. They say that's because of the fact that there's still prisoners out there. So life isn't quite back to normal for Sierra Leoneans, who are being reminded on a daily basis of how close they came to having a military takeover happen on Sunday.
They've acknowledged it was an attempted coup, but why? What was the motivation here?
It's not really clear yet. I spoke to a few people in Freetown to try and get a sense of what they think might be behind it. And several reasons were given. First of all, there was a really tense post-election period. There were general elections in June, and those were contested by the opposition. The opposition refused to go into parliament for a few months, and it was only resolved in October after some mediation by the African Union and other regional bodies. The reality in Sierra Leone is that a lot of people rely on their connection, their party affiliation for things like civil servant jobs, for access to, you know, certain benefits. And what some people have told me in Sierra Leone is that even amongst the armed forces, promotions, things like deployments to certain areas are dependent on what party you're part of. So even the armed forces are invested in the political process. And that might have been a motivation for why some members of the armed forces decided to do a military takeover. And then there's also the fact that these elections were criticized by international observers. They said there was a lack of transparency, some instances of intimidation and violence. And then the third reason that's been cited is inflation is at over 40% in Sierra Leone. There's lots of unemployment, and lots of people blame the government for how bad the economy is performing.
Maini Jones. Finland has now closed its entire land border with Russia. It's accusing Moscow of trying to destabilise its neighbour by funnelling asylum seekers into Finland, and comes as relations between the two countries are at a very low point. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
This is the last of 8 border crossings with Russia that Finland will close. accusing its neighbour of channelling asylum seekers its way deliberately in what the Finnish Prime Minister has called a hybrid attack on his country. He's warned Russia it has to stop. In a normal month, around 30 people request asylum in Finland. This month, 900 have arrived from countries including Afghanistan and Somalia. Finland joined NATO earlier this year after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and it's thought this is part of Moscow's response, although Russia denies that. Officers from the EU's border agency Frontex are due in Finland this week to help patrol its long eastern border, much of which runs through the forest.
Sarah Rainsford. At a recent summit of African Union leaders and heads of government of the Caribbean community, CARICOM, leaders issued a draft proclamation which stated that African and Caribbean countries would form a united front to persuade European nations to pay for historic mass crimes relating to the slave trade. At the meeting in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, they said that they would explore litigation options and work with the UN to assess whether acts of enslavement constituted serious violations of human rights. Carlos Lopez is an African Union High Representative for Partnerships with Europe and a former UN Under Secretary General. Krupa Paddy asked him how important it was to persuade European nations to pay for slavery reparations.
It's very significant because it comes in the aftermath of the Samoa Agreement that has been signed between the European Union and the African Caribbean Pacific group of countries. The discussions towards signing this agreement have been very difficult, and most countries did not really think that this agreement was going to bring anything substantial in their relations with Europeans, and 39 countries decided not to sign. And we have to see from the 44 that signed which ones are really going to ratify.
Were they difficult because of the painful legacy of slavery, or were they difficult because individual nations are not necessarily on the same page about this matter?
It's a combination of a colonial legacy that has been the subject of a lot of contestation on the previous agreements between the European Union and this group of countries, because it's about trade on commodities. And as we know, the colonial legacy is very much one that went from slavery to commodity producing for exports to the benefit of others, not necessarily the countries that had the natural resources. So after six decades of independence, we are still in the same situation of having most African and Caribbean countries either dependent on one or two commodities or dependent on handouts and structural problems that have not been resolved. So if we trace back the historical reasons why there has been no evolution, is because the engagements with the European Union have not been to the benefit of these countries from the time they were colonies all the way to today.
I wonder what you say to those who believe that it is important to move forward now from that difficult legacy of slavery.
I think it's very important that we have now entered a stage in the debate where talking about diversity has become much more accepted, and in certain countries even required. Diversity aspects are entering the realm of politics, but also of policy. And I think this is very welcome and creates the space for much more action on the part of those who have been affected and that were stigmatized and felt that until now they had to fight a battle that didn't have any space politically to succeed. And the fact that the Africans and the Caribbean countries are pulling together in one direction is very significant. The Africans just got a victory at the UN that is quite unique, by having all the countries of the Global South voting a resolution they proposed on centrality of tax to move out of the OECD, which is basically the club of the rich countries, into the UN. These demonstrations of agency are becoming more common. You had the Africans that have been accepted as members of the G20 as a union. And it's very heartening to see that it's not just unity amongst Africans in the continent, but unity of Africans in general, including their diaspora in the Caribbean.
Carlos Lopez speaking to Krupa Paddy. For most, a cruise is a chance to see some of the world and put your feet up. One man did precisely this in Marseille in the south of France, where a spider thought his toe might be the perfect place to lay its eggs. Here's Terry Egan.
If Colin Blake and his wife thought a cruise to Marseille would be the perfect holiday to celebrate their 35th wedding anniversary, what they probably didn't know was that's exactly where wolf spiders often sail to, arriving in the port on cargo ships. So when Colin noticed his toe turning purple and swelling up, he thought it might just be because of his new sandals. The day after, though, he visited the onboard doctor, who told him he'd been bitten.
It was really going purple, yellow, all kinds of colours. And the ship's doctor, with a scalpel, split my toe open and then squeezed out what looked like milk, but with tea leaves in. And I'm going, like, what's those little dots? He said, they're eggs, but don't worry, I've got them all.
Except that he hadn't. Back in England, from where Colin had started his journey, doctors discovered that one of the eggs had hatched after all. For weeks, a spider had been eating its way through his toe and now had to be popped out. Colin will probably think twice about where he chooses to put his feet up next time round.
It's the biggest-selling series of compilation albums in the world and has inspired copycat efforts in the Netherlands, Spain, Japan and the United States. And on Tuesday, Now That's What I Call Music marked 40 years since it was first released in the UK. The albums, which compile the latest pop hits, have sold more than 120 million copies and documented four decades of musical trends. Our music correspondent Mark Savage takes a look back at the series.
Phil Collins' You Can't Hurry Love was track one, side one, on the first ever Now That's What I Call Music album. Since then, the compilations have featured more than 2,000 artists and 675 number one singles, covering everything from Queen I want to break free to the Venga Boys. Robbie Williams has appeared more than anyone else, 38 times in total. And the most featured group are the X Factor winners, Little Mix. The series has now hit its 116th edition, and sales are strong despite the advent of streaming services like Spotify. The DJ Mark Goodyear has been the voice of the adverts for the Now albums since 1992. He says there's still a place for compilations curated by humans rather than playlists powered by artificial intelligence.
AI doesn't know which song was playing when you walk down the aisle, and AI hasn't had a record played at a funeral. And the people who are really good at selecting records, either on a streaming service or in a compilation album like Now or on the radio, they're very few and far between.
If the series manages to continue, it's scheduled to release its 200th edition just in time for Christmas 2051. It's only just begun.
Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.